Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whomever you love, we welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. May you leave your daily burdens at the door, open your minds and hearts, and be fully present for this time of fellowship and spiritual re-energizing. I'm Reverend Christy Anderson, an interfaith minister and member of this congregation. It's my privilege to serve as worship associate. I'm joined today by our worship leader, Cal Fry, and our guest musicians, the Celtic Clan of Kent. I'd like to share an important news update from Becky Klein, who is representing the Ministerial Search Committee. Today, the Ministerial Search Committee kicks off a listening project, The Voices of the UUCK. The key message, we need to hear your voice. Each of you has two opportunities to be heard and to help us discover what we need to know to try to find a new minister we will fall in love with and who will fall in love with us.
We hallow this time together by kindling the lamp of our heritage. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. The words of the Reverend Mark Bellatini. For religion to be significant, it has to provide more than the comforts of community. It also has to provide opportunities for deepening, for what I call spiritual growth, and for the casting down of false images of stereotypes, which hurts us all. A good religion has to open us to the real diversity of our modern world. For our work as liberal religious people is not to be competitive with others and to find ways to supersede others, but rather to find ways to supersede ourselves, to grow beyond our limitations and our constrictive boundaries, each and every one of us. Diversity, you see, must not end up being a sort of feel-good religion or slogan, a word we keep in our back pocket to make us feel like we're broad-minded. Diversity is a gift, but it cannot be a gift unless it is received. It is only received when there are hands and hearts open enough to receive it, and the opening of fists into welcoming hands and welcoming hearts is our spiritual work. Come, let us worship together.
Let us now join in a time of prayer. Spirit of love and life, be with us as we enter into this week which celebrates American freedom. Soften our hearts with compassion in remembrance of those who have yet to savor the freedom that is promised to all. This nation, as well as our own voices and hands, have not fulfilled our lofty aspirations of liberty and equality. So on this July 4th holiday, may we recommit ourselves to the imperative, discomforting justice work our loving faith obligates us to undertake. And may we lift up gratitude in remembrance of the gifts for which we are abundantly blessed, in hope, in service, and in thanksgiving, we say amen.
It's said that if you ask two UUs a question, you'll get at least three answers. Unitarian Universalism has a tradition of freedom, something we call freedom of the pulpit and freedom of the pew, if you get down to the details. This means that basically I'm giving you my particular thoughts and vision this morning, but on other days you'll find other people standing here, often with differing views. Ours is a covenantal religion, not a creedal one. So while we are agreed to meet together here in celebration and support, you are free to hold your own beliefs while still finding a welcome here with us. And it's that freedom of belief that I'm addressing today. I'm never done writing a sermon. There's always another book to read. And in fact, I was adding things to this one on my trip down here this morning. That got me into trouble in graduate school as well. So this is the result of a couple of years of my thinking about humanist ethics and combining that with having read Timothy Ferris's book, The Science of Liberty. I am, like Ferris, fond of a quotation from Richard Feynman, who said, "In physics, the truth is rarely perfectly clear, and that is certainly universally the case in human affairs. Hence, what is not surrounded by uncertainty cannot be the truth." So I'm told when I was a boy, I was an obnoxious know-it-all. Funny, I was just told that last month. I used to read everything I could get my hands on, including the backs of cereal boxes, and I really wanted to be Mr. Wizard when I grew up. I was blessed with patient grandparents. My mom's father was a nurseryman who tended his trees in the acres next door to our house in Wayne County. And boy, I used to devil that man. Many times he would drag me back to the house telling Mom that he'd had enough of me and he absolutely needed to get some work done that day. But both my grandparents' homes held delights for young explorers. In a window of the dining room, where it caught the sun most of the day, my grandfather had a radiometer. You know these things. It's a glass bulb containing a little whirligig of vanes. They're colored white on one side and black on the other. And when light struck the radiometer, the vanes would go spinning around faster when the light was brighter. So Grandpa asked me one day if I had figured it out. I was sure I knew how it worked, and I talked about photons coming in and bouncing off the panels, and that's what drove the vanes around, until my grandfather pointed out that it was spinning in the opposite direction. I understood the particle theory of light, but I didn't know much about thermodynamics and heat engines yet. But I learned several things that day. One of them is an important one about certainty and about doubt. Francis Bacon, one of the first to apply the scientific method, once said, "If a man will begin with certainties, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he will end in certainties." Now, I do not pretend to draw any parallels between myself and Francis Bacon or the physicist and Nobel laureate Richard Feynman. But I love reading Feynman. He expressed his motivation as simply the pleasure of finding things out. Oh, yeah. But as I learned that day with the radiometer, real understanding comes from careful observation and questioning what you think you saw. Another of Feynman's definition of science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. But Feynman himself was one of those experts, and not immune from ignorance. And no one believed in his own ignorance more than he himself. He had learned at an early age that it's easiest to fool yourself. Or as John Hart put it, the essence of wisdom is to remain suspicious of what you want to be true, and most suspicious of what you most want to be true. So with that preface, the declaration that we honor this weekend holds as axiomatic that the people may alter or abolish a government that denies their human rights. It appeals to evidence that King George was guilty of just such conduct, concluding that the colonists were entirely justified in dissolving their political bands with England. This declaration, however, was not the revolutionary thing to come of those days in meeting houses in New York and Philadelphia. I hold that it was really the Constitution of 1787, which was the scientific document of the Bacon School. The founders of our country were scientists. Franklin was one of the leading experimentalists of his day. On July 4th, 1776, while the debate over the Declaration of Independence wore on in Philadelphia, Jefferson meticulously recorded the temperature at 6 and 9 a.m., 1 and 9 p.m. It reached a comfortable 76 degrees that day. And I'm pretty sure he was dead accurate. Washington sent rare birds sent them off to Philadelphia's new Natural History Museum from his estate at Mount Vernon. And once Washington and Tom Paine went boating after dark on a creek that was crossing Washington's property, lighting matches and holding them down to the water surface to determine whether the water caught fire from petroleum floating on top or from swamp gas bubbling up from below. They had a healthy distrust of experts, and they needed to see things for themselves. Beyond the southern landholders' suspicion of those merchant New Englanders and vice versa, many of them were doubtful of their own beliefs. And oddly enough, Feynman had something to say on this. In a lecture at the University of Washington in 1963, he observed that the government of the United States was developed under the idea that nobody knew how to make a government or how to govern. The result is to invent a system to govern when you don't know how. And the way to arrange it is to permit a system like we have, wherein new ideas can be developed and tried out and thrown away. The writers of the Constitution knew about the value of doubt. In the age that they lived, for instance, science had already developed far enough to show the possibilities and potentialities that are the result of having uncertainty, the value of having the openness of possibility. The fact that you are not sure means that it is possible that there is another way someday. That openness of opportunity, or that openness of possibility, is the opportunity. Doubt and discussion are essential to progress. The United States government, in that respect, is new. It's modern. It is scientific. And it's all messed up, too. Senators sell their votes for a dam in their state, discussions get all excited, lobbying replaces the minority's chance to represent itself, and so forth. The government of the United States is not very good, but it, with the possible exception of the government of England, is the greatest government on the earth today. It is the most satisfactory, the most modern, but not very good. What is not surrounded by uncertainty cannot be the truth. Enough of those early Americans understood this to accomplish something novel. Benjamin Franklin addressed the Constitutional Convention on its last day assembled. He said, "I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve. But I am not sure that I shall ever approve them. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information, on further consideration, to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment, and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. Thus, I consent, sir, to this Constitution, Because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. So the playwright and confidence man Wilson Meisner once said, "I respect faith, but doubt is what gets you an education." So we can compare the American Revolution with the French Revolution, which was driven by philosophy, not by science, where Bacon began with uncertainty and was guided by experiment. "I think, therefore I am," René Descartes, began with first principles and attempted to build an entire philosophy from there. But the most influential philosopher at this time was likely Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who began by saying, "Let's begin by laying facts aside," and yet argued for true ideas of humanity's primordial innocence and the descent into civilization that followed. From such a foundation, the French Revolution quickly became a plague of true believers, imposing virtue from above, forcing the people to be free. The Americans then in Paris were appalled, and Thomas Paine was nearly guillotined just days before Robespierre was brought down himself. I don't think America is quite at that stage, not just yet. But uncomfortable truths are, we see, dismissed as fake news, and true believers abound. There are several experiments being staged in our country. The current debate over health care is just one of many. The state of Kansas has been running a multi-year study on the effectiveness of trickle-down economics, to the point where the Republican legislature has revolted against Governor Sam Brownback and voted to raise taxes rather than continuing to cut services. It's taken 5 years of real austerity to show there is no magic in cutting taxes for Kansas. Unfortunately, it looks like we will have to see some plain evidence for global warming before we can take action. Perhaps when Mar-a-Lago sinks beneath the Florida surf. Doubting the abilities or theories of our political opponents, we are in danger of doubting the institutions of our government. Depending on your politics, you can find righteous anger in the actions of the president, or perhaps the president before him, the Supreme Court, or our Congress, state legislatures, school boards, dog catchers. We live, as the old curse would put it, in interesting times. But however frustrated I have been with those elected to serve in Washington, I've never lost my faith in the fundamental principles and mechanism of our democracy. Doubt the authorities. Doubt yourself. But stop just short of cynicism. There's a fine distinction I'm drawing here. Commonly, doubt and cynicism are used as synonyms, or at least fraternal twins from the family of things to be avoided. To pick an example from the world of Google, an anonymous blogger asks, "Can truth be discovered by way of doubt and cynicism? Or does that doubt and cynicism prejudice our minds and lead us to project our assumptions onto the text?" But doubt is not the same thing as cynicism. Cynicism is when doubt goes particularly bad. Honest doubt gives way to dishonest cynicism. The cynic is no longer open to the possibility that his doubts are unfounded. Cynics doubt because they question motives and no longer recognize that sometimes folks advocate genuine truths for partisan motives. Cynics are unable to trust opinions or data other than their own. They seek news outlets whose opinions mirror their own, avoiding exposure to conflicting sentiments. Their hope is to maintain the system they know because change is risky and might not work. But if you're not satisfied with the direction you're headed, you've got to turn the wheel. John Ortberg is a Presbyterian pastor in Menlo Park, California, and is the author of several books on faith, and he describes the difference this way. Give a skeptic a hug, and he will doubt that you really mean it. Give a cynic a hug, and he will check his wallet to see if you've picked his pocket. Cynicism is a means of delaying answering the question, hopefully forever. It can so poison a dispute that no resolution may be found. Cynics have gone beyond doubt into that negative form of certainty that is as much a form of blind faith as can be found in any other true believer. Theists and atheists alike have shared this view. C.S. Lewis said, "If ours is an examined faith, we should be unafraid to doubt. If doubt is eventually justified, we were believing what clearly was not worth believing. But if doubt is answered, our faith grows stronger." And I'm really very fond of the vignette illustrated by Ruth Gendler when she says, "Faith lives in the same apartment building as doubt. When Faith was out of town visiting her uncle in the hospital, doubt fed the cat and watered the asparagus fern. Faith is comfortable with doubt because she grew up with him. Their mothers are cousins. Faith is not dogmatic about her beliefs like some of her relatives. Her friends fear that Faith is a bit stupid. They whisper that she is naive, and she depends on doubt to protect her from the meanness of life. In fact, it is the other way around. It is faith who protects doubt from cynicism." The second verse of America the Beautiful goes like this. "America, America, God mend thy every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law." The fact that you are not sure means that it's possible that there's another way someday. That openness of possibility is an opportunity. Doubt and discussion are essential to progress. Confirm thy soul in self-control and look to liberty as our law. Unitarian Universalism embraces doubt. The congregation at Belleville, in their welcoming statement, says that after the service, you are invited to come chat with people where all your questions will be answered and all your answers will be questioned. Right now, our denomination is being challenged to become as inclusive as we claim to be, to live up to our proud words. We can do this work. We say ours is not a faith in the one truth, but we're all on the path towards truth. We do not say we have the certain faith, but we retain doubts. These doubts allow us to grow into something better. Like Franklin, I consent to this theology and these principles because I expect no better and because I am not sure that it is not the best. Blind faith is a form of insecurity. Those that would silence doubt are filled with fear. Their houses are built on shifting sands. But those who fear not doubt and know its use are founded on rock. It is to the wise as a staff to the blind. Doubt is the attendant of truth. We need that living sort of faith, the faith that understands doubt, that goes hand in hand with it. Or to misquote Ronald Reagan, quoting an old Russian proverb, "Proверия не проверия," verify, but trust. It must be possible to live ethically with a genuine concern for the happiness of other sentient beings without presuming to know things about which we are patently ignorant. We are bound to one another. Our conversation with one another has not reached an end. There need be no scheme of rewards and punishments transcending this life to justify our moral intuitions or to render them effective in guiding our behavior in the world. The only angels that we need to invoke are those of our own better nature, reason, honesty, and love. The only demons we must fear are those that lurk inside every human mind: willful ignorance, hatred, greed, and blind faith. If you are who you were, we have failed. If you are who you were and the person next to you is who he or she was, if none of us have changed since the day we came in here, we have failed. The purpose of this community, of any church, temple, zendo, mosque, is to help its people grow. We do this through encounters with the unknown, in ourselves, in one another, in the other, whoever that might be for us, however hard that might be, because these encounters have many gifts to offer, and we have much to learn from working together. So may you go forth from here this morning, not who you were, but who you could be. So may we all.